has an element of blank. It cannot recollect when it began, or if there were a day when it was not. It has no future but itself. Its infinite realms contain its past, enlightened to perceive new periods of pain.
Data flow
swirling through your radio.
A smash, flash, drastic, splashtic show called the Ed Shep Radio Experiment. A sweet spice, super sizzle, sparkle, snow. An audio beep show by Van Gogh. So slide right up and say hello to the Ed Shep Radio Experiment.
The Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Let's start the show. The Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Ed Shep.
Continued contractions of head and neck muscles is one of the most common forms of headache. The other common variety is vascular headache, which involves changes in blood pressure in the head. Migraine headaches are of the vascular type. Genetic factors play a role in determining who will have migraines, but many other factors are important as well. A major difficulty in treating migraine headache is that changes occur throughout the course of the headache. Blood vessels may at first constrict and then dilate. Changing levels of neurotransmitters have also been noted. While a number of drugs can relieve migraine pain, their usefulness often depends on when they are taken. Some are only effective if taken at the outset. Several drugs for the prevention of migraine have been developed in recent years, including serotonin agonists, which mimic the action of this key brain chemical. Prompt administration of these drugs is important. Drugs are also the common treatment for tension headache, although attempts to use biofeedback to control muscle tension have had some success. Physical methods such as hot or cold applications often provide additional, if only temporary, relief. Low back pain. The combination of painkillers and modest amounts of a muscle relaxant are usually prescribed for the first-time low back pain patient. At the initial examination, the physician will also note if the patient is overweight or works under conditions that offer little opportunity for exercise. Although bed rest may be necessary for severe back problems, exercise is now considered to be an important addition to treatment and can help speed recovery for many patients with low back pain. Exercise helps reduce stress on the lower back by increasing flexibility and strength. In some cases, a full neurological examination may be necessary, including tests to determine if there may be a ruptured disc or other source of pressure on the cord or nerve roots. Sometimes x-rays will show a disc problem that can be helped with surgery. Milder analgesics and electrical stimulation can be very effective for low back pain. What is not effective is long-term use of muscle relaxant tranquilizers. Many specialists are convinced that chronic use of these drugs is detrimental to the back pain patient, adding to depression and increasing pain. Massage and manipulative therapy are used by some clinicians, but except for individual patient reports, their usefulness is still undocumented. Cancer pain. The pain of cancer can result from the pressure of a growing tumor or the infiltration of tumor cells into the other organs, or the pain can come about as the result of radiation or chemotherapy. These treatments can cause fluid accumulation and swelling, irritate or destroy healthy tissue causing pain and inflammation, and possibly sensitize nerve endings. Ideally, the treatment for cancer pain is to remove the cancerous tissue. When that is not possible, pain can be treated by any or all of the currently available therapies, electrical stimulation, psychological methods, surgery, and strong painkillers. Arthritis pain. Arthritis is a general descriptive term meaning a disorder of the joints. The two most common forms are osteoarthritis that typically affects the fingers and may spread to important weight-bearing joints in the spine or hips, and rheumatoid arthritis, an inflammatory joint disease associated with swelling, congestion, and thickening of the soft tissue around joints. Current treatments for arthritis include aspirin, acetaminophen, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen. Steroid drugs, anti-inflammatory agents modeled after the body's own chemicals produced from the adrenal gland, were introduced and hailed as lifesavers in the 1950s. But long-term use of steroids has serious consequences, among them the lowering of resistance to infection, hemorrhaging, and facial puffiness, producing the so-called moon face. Arthritis is best treated early. A modest program of drugs combined with exercise can do much to restore full function and forestall long-term degenerative changes. Exercise in warm water is especially good, since the water is both relaxing and provides buoyancy that makes exercises easier to perform. Physical treatments with warm or cold compresses are helpful sources of temporary pain relief. Neurogenic pain. The most difficult pains to treat are those that result from damage to the peripheral nerves or to the central nervous system itself. Among other notoriously painful neurogenic disorders is pain from an amputated or paralyzed limb, so-called phantom pain, that affects a significant number of amputees and paraplegia patients. Various combinations of antidepressants and weak narcotics are sometimes effective. Surgery, too, is occasionally successful. Many experts now think that electrical stimulation techniques hold the greatest promise for relieving these pains. Psychogenic pain. Some causes of pain are not due to past disease or injury, nor is there any detectable sign of damage inside or outside the nervous system. Such pain may benefit from any psychological pain therapy. It is also possible that some new methods used to diagnose pain may be useful. One method gaining in popularity is thermography, which measures the temperature of surface tissue as a reflection of blood flow. A color-coded thermogram of a person with a headache or other painful condition often shows an altered blood supply to the painful area, appearing as a darker or lighter shade than the surrounding area, or the corresponding part on the other side of the body. Thus, an abnormal thermogram in a patient who complains of pain, in the absence of any other evidence, may provide a valuable clue that can lead to a diagnosis and treatment.
All day long,
Rosario.
Oh.
Rosario.
Oh.
Rosario.
Knock it off!
What you're feeling are pangs of guilt.
Pain is the fifth vital sign. Blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and temperature have been defined for many centuries as the basic vital signs that indicate good health. These vital signs are important clues for doctors to diagnose and treat illness, and they also provide doctors with a simple baseline compass to determine if a patient is ill. It is now recognized that pain is also a sign of illness. Pain can provide a useful tool for doctors to measure and monitor a patient's state of health, illness, and well-being. Moreover, making sure healthcare providers check for pain is usually the first step in recognition and management. Although pain is subjective, can vary from one patient to another and from one day to the next, healthcare providers attempt to measure pain as objectively as possible. Pain is usually determined by asking the patient what their pain is like and relating that pain level to a scale. In adult patients, this scale is often a numeric measurement between 0 and 10, with the number 0 meaning no pain and 10 representing the worst pain imaginable. Because children may be unable to grasp the concept of numbers and how they relate to pain, a pediatric pain scale is utilized for them. This scale is comprised of expressions on picture faces. 6 faces are normally displayed in front of the child, with the first face representing a happy expression and the 6th face describing a grimacing face suffering from intolerable pain. Both the adult and pediatric pain scales are placed in front of each patient, and they are asked to point or state the level of pain that describes what their pain is like. Patients who are unable to speak are also carefully observed for levels of pain. These pain measurements are determined by closely monitoring the patient's other vital signs, heart rate, respiration, pulse, and temperature, as well as behaviors such as their level of agitation, irritation, and restlessness. Pain scales are useful indicators for doctors to get a sense of how much pain a patient is experiencing. They are also very important measures that can determine if treatments are effective or simply not working to combat pain. Because pain is such an important part of diagnosis and treatment, the need for doctors, nurses, and other healthcare providers to register pain as a vital sign is becoming a mandated part of medical care. These efforts are just one indication of the heightened awareness of pain as a potentially overlooked source of suffering. Adding pain as the fifth vital sign may help overcome needless suffering from pain that is treatable if we are just aware of it.
It cannot recollect when it began, or if there was a time when it was not. It has no future but itself.
By that what's meant is, it really doesn't hurt.
I'll put her whole darn fist inside. That's it. Now it's over. There'll be a puffiness around your cheeks. You'll have to eat soft food for 3 more weeks. And if you'll kindly stop those ghastly shrieks, I'm through.
I was peaceful at 9 o'clock in the morning, and the dentist gave me Novocaine and everything, and around 5, I went into great pain in that area. I'd like to say a few words about Novocaine versus pain. First of all, Novocaine does not kill pain, it postpones it, and gives it a chance to build little pain buddies over to the side. You know, about 5 o'clock, we're going to kill that hole over there. But you can get them at the drugstore. I said, okay, I know where to get them, you know. And I ran into the drugstore. I was so happy, man. I said, hey, druggist, come here. Give me a can of Midol, and it's for me. But I want you to know that, boy, I took them all night long and no pain. It didn't come back for nothing. And in the morning, I had a little headache. I took one for that and gone. That stuff is beautiful. And you women don't tell anybody about it. They keep all the goodies to yourself. And I tell you, fellas, there's nothing wrong with me. My voice is no higher than it used to be. Oh, that's the truth. Of course, every 28 days, I get a little irritable.
Collecting beautifully patterned Kona snails off the northeast coast of Australia may sound like hard work, but it's not all boats, sun, fresh air, and sea. Dr. Bruce Livid of Melbourne University takes it all in stride, though. For nearly a decade, he and his team of enthusiastic colleagues, students, and friends have sought and studied these spectacular snails. But why is a neuroscientist interested in these animals? Why is a neuroscientist interested in these animals? Besides, apart from their spectacularly patterned shells, the mollusks have a secret weapon. A typical poisonous snake might unleash a couple of different nerve toxins on its furry victim, but what the conus lacks in speed, it more than makes up for in poison. These snails are positively brimming with
nasties.
Often shoving around 50 individual toxic mini-proteins into their victim. Under normal circumstances, is a finely honed thinking machine. The reason being that all of its nerves are able to function correctly, sending messages, receiving messages, processing the information, and giving a pretty good output. If the brain is like an organic computer, then being stung by a conus is a bit like pouring a pint of ale on a laptop. Fizz, bang, splatter. Dead. The reason is that each of the tiny proteins that make up the toxic cocktail are targeted at different parts of the nervous system. These snails don't just blow the bloody doors off your brain. They terminate it from every conceivable angle. But not all the components in the venom are deadly. Some turn out to be good for you. As they say, no pain, no gain.
No pain, no pain, no pain, no pain, no gain, no gain, no gain. No pain, no pain, no pain, no gain.
What about the future of pain? Painkiller research can be riddled with problems, side effects, dependency, efficacy. What about a painkiller as effective as morphine, but with no apparent side effects? The relatively few humans who have witnessed a death by a snail have noted the absence of pain. And Bruce Livett and his team now know why. One of the toxins in the sting of the Conus victoriae species is a string of just 16 amino acids. This tiny protein, ACV1, binds to the bits of the brain that would normally allow us to feel pain and
shuts them down.
What we potentially have here is a powerful new generation of analgesics. This new drug has done very well in preclinical trials and is now undergoing toxicity tests prior to entering clinical trials, the rights for development into a drug having been bought by a company called Metabolic Pharmaceuticals. So, spare a thought for our British plant-bound relatives. Maybe they deserve a little more respect. After all, with relatives like the Conus, you don't need to be pretty.
Its infinite realms contain its past. Enlightened to perceive new periods of pain. Our pain is so overwhelming that it blots out our sense of ever having experienced anything but pain. The sufferer remembers the past as having consisted only of pain, lines 5 to 8. In the grip of pain, we see only continuing and relentless pain in the future. Our lives and identities have become consumed by pain. Our lives, we ourselves, are only pain.
Marijuana is well studied in the scientific and medical literature and clearly has effective pain-relieving properties. It can also have other effects that may help decrease nausea or stimulate appetite. For many, it may also stimulate a sense of well-being. However, for many other individuals, it may have surprising counterintuitive effects, because marijuana may actually induce the opposite state of euphoria. That is, it may sometimes be unpleasant, producing anxiety, panic attacks, confusion, disorientation, or agitation. In all patients or individuals using marijuana, this drug stimulates the sympathetic nervous system and therefore increases the heart rate. Stimulating this system for certain kinds of pain symptoms may end up being counterproductive for producing pain relief. Although marijuana has some properties that can be exploited medicinally, it also has medical problems associated with its use, particularly when it is inhaled as smoke. These problems may include a risk of causing cancer. Marijuana users have tried to excuse and dismiss this carcinogenic risk, indicating that if they don't inhale it as deeply or smoke as often as they would regular cigarettes, it should not be as high a cancer risk as smoking tobacco. Yet studies indicate that in fact marijuana users may inhale more deeply and hold the smoke in their mouths and lungs longer than for regular cigarettes. Modest use of marijuana may be equivalent to smoke exposure through use of cigarettes for some. This may increase the risk of oral, esophageal, and lung cancers. One of the other problems with marijuana lies within its delivery system, whereby smoking marijuana produces smoke that is hot and irritating for the lungs. Some patients and individuals find this heat and irritation objectionable, and others do not. It is particularly problematic for those who have not smoked before. At present, there is a medication called Marinol that has the active ingredient found in the marijuana plant called tetrahydrocannabinol. When Marinol is prescribed, it is usually for patients who have problems with cancer-related
in anorexia or nausea. Another novel product recently released in India is a spray made from marijuana that can be applied to the oral mucosa and has quick onset like smoked marijuana without the smoke exposure. To date, the field of medicine is conflicted about the use of medical marijuana because it clearly has properties that are advantageous to some, but other properties that are not of benefit and may be of harm. There are many other medications that can combat untoward symptoms of anorexia, nausea, and pain, and these medicines are usually just as effective as marijuana. Therefore, these medications continue to be more mainstream choices that physicians can offer to their patients. Moreover, the federal government seems determined to deter the legalized use of marijuana with our current legal healthcare system. At present, several states have legalized medical marijuana use for patients, but the federal government has not allowed physicians to prescribe it. Thus, the debate about medical marijuana persists. There are many patients who feel that it is not only their right to utilize marijuana for medical purposes, but they also believe that it is their only hope for effective pain relief or symptom management.
After 3 decades of chronic, searing pain, Marie Dabrowski was finally able to sleep. She was able to think, and sometimes, thanks to her new pills, she could almost forget about her fibromyalgia, a mysterious nerve disorder characterized by fatigue, migraine headaches, and full body aches. But Dabrowski's respite did not last. The medication responsible for her 2-year break from daily misery was OxyContin, and about a month ago, Dabrowski's doctor cut her off. The move had nothing to do with callousness or lack of concern. Instead, her doctor was spooked by a proposed Virginia law designed to intensify scrutiny of physicians who prescribed the drug. In the end, it was the prospect of police interrogation that pushed her doctor over the edge. When I went into the office, a receptionist explained to me that it was the DEA that was the problem, and that my doctor was scared of getting in trouble, she says. I told them that this was dangerous. People on OxyContin finally have something that keeps the pain away, and if the pain comes back, they're going to commit suicide. Widespread abuse of OxyContin, a painkiller made by Purdue Pharma LP, was first reported in the media about a year ago, called hillbilly heroin because early cases of addiction surfaced in Appalachia. The pills were being crushed and then snorted or injected by users who found the drug cheap and easy to obtain. Once touted by its manufacturer as a safe and effective alternative to highly addictive morphine, Oxy quickly became the scourge of law enforcement, spreading across the country with lightning speed, leaving hundreds of addicts in its wake. Even as Purdue hastily promised to produce OxyContin in a form less vulnerable to abuse, legislators in at least 17 states pushed to create strict prescription tracking programs, while others took steps to limit the number of OxyContin pills that people on Medicaid can receive. The Department of Justice proposed a national crackdown on painkiller abuse, and some states are considering laws that would ban OxyContin, as well as its main ingredient, oxycodone, a synthetic opiate prescribed to millions of patients since 1916. It is difficult to argue with laws intended to make it harder for addicts to get drugs, and the DEA has said that it does not want to limit the supply to those with the legitimate need for relief. But there are dangerous side effects to the new restrictive policies on prescription painkillers, chief among them widespread unnecessary suffering. Patients with chronic pain, routinely undertreated in the past, had in recent years begun to get adequate relief, thanks in part to OxyContin, one of the few drugs that reduces or eliminates pain without nausea or damage to vital organs. The onslaught of regulations designed to curtail OxyContin abuse now threatens to reverse those advances. Increasing numbers of the estimated 30 to 50 million people in the country who suffer from some form of chronic pain say the OxyContin crackdown means they can no longer get adequate or sustained relief. For some, the new rules and medical practices create frustrating delays in receiving medication, but for others, there is no help at all. Cancer patients and sufferers of debilitating diseases report that they are getting ineffective dosages of OxyContin, running out of places to fill legal prescriptions for it, or finding themselves without doctors, many of whom choose to avoid OxyContin headaches by sending patients to overwhelmed pain specialists struggling with the same regulations.
Our simmering fear of painkiller abuse, brought to a boil by the OxyContin scare, has created a world of hurt for legitimate victims of illness. The war on drugs has increasingly become a war on patients. Americans have something of a tortured relationship with opioids, pain relievers derived from real or synthetic opium that work on the central nervous system. Doctors were the earliest targets of the prescription drug panic. As early as 1914, with the passage of the Harrison Narcotic Act, the government identified doctors as agents of addiction who needed to be controlled if narcotic abuse was to be abolished. The law, refined by a Supreme Court decision in 1919, made it illegal for doctors to prescribe opioids to addicted patients and required doctors who prescribed the drugs to register with the IRS. State laws passed over the next few decades added more specific hurdles for doctors, stronger penalties for overprescribing, and in some cases, mandatory use of triplicate forms that gave state regulators a copy of every prescription written for opioids and other highly addictive but medically useful drugs, a category defined by the government in 1970 as Schedule II narcotics. Most doctors reacted to the laws and a growing public fear of abuse by avoiding patients with pain that required strong medication. There were and are exceptions. Doctors who treat cancer patients have typically plodded through the extra paperwork and state scrutiny in order to prescribe opioids. But the vast majority of physicians in states with triplicate regulations responded to additional scrutiny by dropping opioids from the list of drugs they would prescribe. A survey that Dahl conducted in the mid-1990s found that only 60% of California's 96,000 doctors, oncologists included, were authorized to write triplicate prescriptions, and that only 40% of these doctors actually did. Other surveys in other states found similar results. The advent of managed care has compounded the problem. Diagnosing chronic pain often requires extra time. X-rays and the usual tests may turn up nothing, even when patients are visibly suffering. And managed care demands extra efficiency. Doctors who participate in that system, with its attendant focus on quickly moving patients in and out of doctors' offices, are extremely pressured for time. Anything that looks like it will take more time is a tremendous disincentive. Greater obstacles to aggressive pain management resulted in more undertreated sufferers of chronic pain. A handful of doctors, aware of the problem, sought to focus on treatment of pain by forming specialized study groups in the early 70s. But it wasn't until 1985 when an article in the New England Journal of Medicine identified a widespread lack of adequate care that victims of undertreated chronic pain became more visible to doctors and the public. The journal article offered new medication and treatment guidelines that became the model for doctors treating pain. Medical schools and regulatory boards also responded, gradually, with dedicated training programs and ethical guidelines for the treatment of pain. By 2000, 24 state medical boards had adopted pain guidelines that specifically advised doctors on the dangers of undertreatment. Meanwhile, large healthcare providers created pain clinics, increasing the number of locations where strong drugs could and would be prescribed. And then, out of the blue, came the OxyContin scare. The problem was with OxyContin's potency, promotion, and chemical formula. OxyContin carried an extremely high dose of oxycodone. It was extremely popular, and its time-release qualities were easily defeated by simply crushing the pill. Towns that didn't have easy access to heroin or other hard drugs became the first Oxy hotspots. Rural Maine, western Pennsylvania, and the Appalachian areas of Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia in early 2001 were the first areas hit. Calls for legislation came quickly, and painkillers of every variety came under new scrutiny. The first controls of the drug sought to cut off abuse by Medicaid patients. There was no body of data indicating that the poor abused the drug more than wealthy Americans, but by the summer of 2001, six states had introduced legislation making it harder for Medicaid patients to get their pills. Other states followed, with regulations aimed at recipients with OxyContin prescriptions or at Medicaid patients in need of pain medications. Vermont ended coverage of OxyContin for all its Medicaid patients. If poor patients needed the pills, said the state's lawmakers, they had to move. In the past 18 months, 17 states set up electronic prescription databases to track doctors who prescribe and patients who receive Schedule II drugs. Meanwhile, legislators in West Virginia are considering a ban of all the drugs that contain oxycodone. One Pennsylvania legislator has introduced a bill that would move OxyContin from Schedule II to Schedule I, a category that includes mescaline, heroin, and other drugs considered to have no medical purpose. Doctors have blanched at the sweeping changes and proposed bans. hands, and their panic has only increased in the wake of cases like that of Dudley Hall, a Bridgeport, Connecticut doctor charged with 36 counts of overprescribing. Sure, they argue, Dr. Hall, who prescribed more OxyContin than any other doctor in his state, deserves to be prosecuted. But Hall was busted by officers posing as patients, and doctors fear that undercover operations will become the norm. The new laws, even if they didn't directly lead to Hall's arrest, make police especially brash, far too confident in their ability to decide which prescriptions are valid or invalid. Many doctors looking for creative ways to deal with new layers of regulations have found loopholes that can result in further suffering for the patients they are willing to keep. Many physicians, for instance, are continuing to prescribe pain medication, but are cutting dosages. For sufferers of chronic pain, who often require increased dosages over time because of increased tolerance to their medication, this is a move that promises less relief in the face of increasing pain. In fact, most users of OxyContin and other strong pain medications are not addicts. For every one case of a robbed pharmacy to get an opioid, there are probably 100 people who are undertreated or appropriately treated. But, adds David Jorensen, director of the Pain and Policy Studies Group at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, America is a country where the treatment of pain is governed by how we perceive the drug abuse problem. As a result, he adds, there's a multiplier effect. Laws aimed at the minority are having an enormous effect on the majority, most of whom feel they can barely survive without their pills. Doctors in many areas are also shuffling pain patients off their rosters. Rather than deal with the increased scrutiny, they're referring patients to pain specialists, many of whom are already overwhelmed. Michael Brennan is dealing with the issue firsthand. About 90% of his practice's 800 patients suffer from non-cancer chronic pain, and Brennan says that he's in danger of burning out, in large part because he's receiving a substantial uptick in referrals. Once patients get their drugs, they are frequently limited to a maximum of 1 month's supply. That means that they run out faster, and then, because pharmacies can no longer carry large supplies, they struggle to find a pharmacy to refill their prescriptions. A further limitation, which is another direct result of the painkiller crackdown, is that many patients are being forced by their doctors to sign contracts in which they promise never to visit another doctor or pharmacy for prescriptions. So, if the pharmacy specified in the agreement doesn't have what the patient needs, the patient has to decide what is worse, to violate a contract by going to another pharmacy, or to forgo medication that makes life livable. Sarah Patterson was forced to make such a choice just last month. Her daughter, Holly, who is 7, suffers from damaged nerves and a degenerative spinal disorder. Essentially, says Patterson, her body doesn't regulate the pressure of her spinal fluid, and the fluid puts pressure on her damaged nerves, which creates the pain. Holly's form of excruciating agony comes and goes. She can spend 3 or 4 months in unrelenting, paralyzing pain, and then enjoy a month of relative comfort, only to have the pain strike suddenly once again. Last month, when the pain hit, Patterson called her daughter's pain clinic, a 2-hour drive from her Central Florida home, to get a prescription for Holly. The doctors didn't answer. In a panic, Patterson went to Holly's local pediatrician, who immediately offered to prescribe medication. But I said, no, you can't do that, Patterson says. I told her I had signed a contract that prohibited me from buying medication from another doctor. Instead, Holly endured another day without relief before getting the right medication from the legal source. Meanwhile, Patterson says she fears that Holly will commit suicide. Every birthday, she blows out her candles and wishes for the pain to go away, Patterson says. She constantly says that she does not want to live. She just asked me 15 minutes ago if she could go ahead and kill herself. Right now, she doesn't understand what it means to terminate her life. But what happens when she gets older? She might actually succeed. Our time is running out. The DEA justifies its steps to limit access to opioids with figures that blame the diversion of OxyContin from patients to addicts for an estimated 300 deaths in 31 states over the past 2 years. As recently as March 22nd, DEA Chief Asa Hutchinson called for more prescription drug tracking to help law enforcement nab addicts and doctors. To be fair, Hutchinson also has stressed that increased enforcement should not affect pain patients, and the DEA's OxyContin Action Plan states that these actions are not intended to impact on the availability of legitimate drug products for medical use. But experts question the sincerity of law enforcement's dedication to those who truly need strong pain medication. There have been no mitigating laws passed in the interest of patients. Jorensen, the pain policy expert, argues that in many states, new prescription laws amount to simple politics. Politicians need to be seen as doing something about drugs, he says. And others fear that Hutchinson's stated attempt to protect legitimate prescribing will go unheeded. With press attention focused on doctor busts and new laws that extend police powers, authorities may not curtail their efforts, but expand them. Some patients are fighting back. Mike Schrader, for example, had his prescription switched from OxyContin to methadone a month ago. At first, the former x-ray technologist didn't mind. The methadone alleviated some of the pain he suffers in his hips and back, the result of 14 separate surgeries, and he was willing to give it a try. But eventually, he discovered that the new pills were weaker than expected. My pain level before OxyContin was an 8 out of 10, he says. With OxyContin, it was on a 4 to 5 level. Now, I'm back up around a 6. Schrader figures that there's no reason to sit back and take the pain. He says that for as long as the methadone fails him, he'll keep asking his doctor for the same level of relief he received with OxyContin. I'm not going to let him force me to suffer just because he's scared to write the prescription, he says. Few victims of chronic pain have Schrader's energy or clarity of mind to protest under treatment, so pain advocates are trying to back them up, to little avail. We are an opiophobic nation, says Barbara Coombs Lee, president of the Compassion in Dying Federation. We have a craziness about this issue, and the effect is that it harms patients in pain and those at the end of life. If OxyContin was taken off the market right now, it would not hurt the drug addicts. It would only hurt the people who need it. The addicts will get another drug. It's going to be us that pays.
Intense pain so dominates us that it displaces everything else in our lives, including our identity. If all we are aware of is pain, then in a sense we have become our pain.
Hypnosis is a widely practiced and time-tested method for managing pain. Early pioneers in the area of hypnosis used it to block the pain of amputations before chemical anesthetics were available. Although hypnotism has been utilized by many as a form of alternative medical therapy for many centuries, it remains today under close scientific scrutiny within the medical community. There are several possible ways that hypnosis could work to block pain. One is that hypnosis decreases the amount of pain signal that gets sent to the brain. Another way hypnosis may work is that it redirects one's attention to something other than the pain. Still another way is that hypnosis may help our mind to know when the pain is there but not to feel it. Studies have shown that nearly all patients with pain can benefit from hypnosis in some way. Hypnosis continues to play an important role in pain management in the 21st century. It offers a rare window into the mind-body connection, revealing cues about the power and control the mind has to both increase pain and reduce it. Hypnotism is an important piece in the mind-body puzzle that allows one's mind and state of consciousness the ability to take charge over the type of pain you are experiencing. Although hypnotism may not be able to cure the underlying cause of the pain, in most cases it can help patients manage it.
Before anesthesia, surgery used to be agony. It's hard to imagine that anyone could have been anything but pleased when painless surgery was introduced in the mid-19th century. And yet, although many welcomed anesthesia, some did object. In Zurich, anesthesia was even outlawed.
Pain is a natural and intended curse of the primal sin. Any attempt to do away with it must be wrong,
claimed the Zurich City Fathers. Painless delivery in childbirth was a particularly contentious issue. Some insisted that
in sorrow thou shalt bring forth children.
Genesis 3:16.
Others, like Dr. Charles de Lucena Meigs, believed that labor pains were a most desirable, salutary, and conservative manifestation of the life force. There was even a belief, expressed in 1847 in the New York Journal of Medicine, that pain was vital to surgical procedure.
David... Pierce, author of The Hedonistic Imperative, suggests that one day the assumption that emotional pain is indispensable may sound just as quaint. He believes that no pain, physical or emotional, is necessary. On the contrary, Pierce argues that we should strive to eradicate suffering in all sentient life, a project which he describes as technically feasible thanks to genetic engineering and nanotechnology, and ethically mandatory on utilitarian grounds. Utilitarianism is the theory that actions are to be judged in terms of their tendency to bring about the greatest happiness for the greatest number. One of the fathers of utilitarianism, John Stuart Mill, suffered from depression in his early 20s. He asked himself if he would be happy if all his socioeconomic, institutional, and legislative aims were fulfilled. To his dismay, an irrepressible self-consciousness distinctly answered, "No." Pierce thinks Mill's instincts were right. No amount of purely environmental improvement can cheat the hedonistic treadmill and permanently recalibrate the brain's set point of well-being, Pierce says. With the current human genome, there would still be suffering in the world even if we recreated a notional Garden of Eden or similar utopia. But if we recalibrate our typical emotional set point, whether through designer drugs or gene therapy, then the greatest happiness principle can be implemented far more successfully than in the wildest dreams of Bentham or Mill. Pierce, who describes himself as a negative utilitarian, that is, someone who seeks to minimize suffering, believes that anyone who holds a classical utilitarian ethic must accept paradise engineering as the only morally acceptable outcome given the biotechnology revolution. Imagine what life would be like without emotional suffering. No fear or anger or sadness or frustration. The idea could make you uneasy. Your first reaction might be, "Thanks for the offer, but I'll keep my blues." Perhaps you suspect that life without your darker moods wouldn't be as rich, as interesting. You might worry that without the bad, you wouldn't be able to appreciate the good, or that you'd go crazy. Maybe without emotional suffering to anchor us down, we would fall into mania, a condition characterized by grandiose notions, disconnected thoughts, poor judgment, and inappropriate behavior. Pierce speculates, however, that one day the hedonistic imperative may be seen as intellectually trite, just as a tome on the merits of anesthesia would be at present. He doesn't think that we need the bad to appreciate the good. He points out that some people endure lifelong emotional depression. If it's possible to be constantly unhappy, then why should it be impossible to be constantly happy? He argues that although at present euphoria is often dysfunctional, one day humans will be able to enjoy the elation of mania while keeping their sanity. According to Pierce, contemporary standards of mental health are pathologically low. He envisages a time when our descendants will enjoy a glorious spectrum of new options for mental superhealth, and speculates that people may opt to combine the goal-oriented energy, optimism, and initiative of a manic high with more grounded emotions like stability, resilience, and serenity. When picturing this world without emotional suffering, Brave New World may come to mind. The inhabitants of Huxley's novel are not immune to unpleasant feelings. When these feelings occur, however, they take soma.
1 cubic centimeter cures 10 gloomy sentiments.
But instead of being desirable, their lives come across as flat. As Pierce argues, in Brave New World, there is no depth of feeling, no ferment of ideas, and no artistic creativity. But the problem may be the limitations of the drug soma, not with the idea of altering one's emotions by taking drugs per se. Pierce claims that even today, the idea that chemically driven happiness must dull and pacify is demonstrably false, as psychostimulants, which increase assertiveness and can improve intellectual performance, have the opposite effect. Fear of change and lack of imagination go halfway to explain why the notion of a life devoid of pain isn't immediately appealing. But perhaps what puts many off is a recognition that suffering can be useful. Some unpleasant emotions are, unfortunately, adaptive. People who are scared of predators are more likely to pass their genes on. Darwinian evolution has powerfully favored the growth of ever more diverse, excruciating, but also more adaptive varieties of psychophysical pain. Pierce argues in The Hedonistic Imperative, its sheer nastiness effectively spurs and punishes the living vehicles of genetic replicators. But suffering isn't just good for our genes, it can also be good for us. Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute of Oxford University, thinks that there is something bad about all suffering, but also points that a substantial amount of suffering currently has an important instrumental function. He gives the example of the useful pain one feels when accidentally placing one's hand on a hot stove. If we removed that suffering, we would have to make adjustments. In this example, what might be needed is some other system that would cause us to quickly withdraw our hand from the stove that wouldn't involve pain. The same ideas would also have to be considered when removing psychological pain. Here, the problem is much more complex, but the desire to avoid suffering is not the only motive that can induce us to improve ourselves and our circumstances, Bostrom says. So if one wanted to get rid of psychological suffering, one should make sure that other elements of psychology were appropriately adjusted so that we would still be motivated to do what we wanted to do. Pierce agrees. He believes that we should replace all pain and malaise with a motivational system based on gradients of well-being. The stick works, but so does the carrot, another trick evolution's discovered. Nature keeps us in line with threats and punishments, and sometimes with rewards. What Pierce and Bostrom advocate is a modern approach, no more physical and emotional punishments, and in their place, an enhanced system of rewards. In other words, a motivation system based entirely on carrots of different sizes. Even if the absolute obsolescence of pain couldn't be achieved, we could still strive to minimize the amount of suffering in the world by relying on motivational systems based to a larger extent on positive emotions and to a lesser extent on negative ones. Whether positive emotions and rewards alone can consistently keep us away from hot stoves and other perils remains to be seen. Rats wired so their pleasure centers are stimulated every time they press a lever keep on pressing until they collapse, having neglected to eat, drink, or sleep. But according to Pierce, contemporary images of opiate-addled junkies and the lever-pressing frenzies of self-stimulating rats are deceptive. Pierce believes that we do not need to choose between perpetual happiness or social intellectual development, since dopamine-driven states of euphoria can enhance exploratory and goal-directed activity and increase the range and diversity of actions an organism finds rewarding. Our descendants may live in a civilization of serenely well-motivated high achievers, animated by gradients of bliss, he says. Their productivity may far eclipse our own. Bostrom believes Pierce's basic idea that suffering is bad and that high-tech neurological interventions are needed to eliminate suffering is plausible, but advises caution. The project will require sophisticated methods and technologies, much more advanced than what is available today. It is not only side effects in the narrow sense that are concerned. All emotions have a natural function. When we trim our feelings, we need to take heed lest we accidentally reduce the fertility of our plots and end up in a sterile, brave new world. This is not a necessary consequence, yet fools will build fools' paradises. I would recommend we go easy on our paradise engineering until we have the wisdom to do it right. Assuming we proceed with wisdom, Bostrom thinks it is definitely possible to abolish all suffering on Earth while not ending up in a sterile, brave new world. If we can muster enough wisdom, a big if, then I think it is feasible in the long term, he says. An objection comes from Bruce Charlton, editor-in-chief of Medical Hypotheses at the University of Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Charlton argues that there is a conflict between the hedonistic imperative and the direction of social evolution.
My feeling is that the world tends to be dominated by power rather than happiness, he says. Any societies which succeeded in making their citizens perfectly happy would probably be overwhelmed by societies of more driven individuals who subordinated present happiness to future goals, such as increased wealth or increased status.
So while Charlton agrees with Pierce that happiness is the goal of individual life, he thinks it is probably not the goal of social systems, which instead tend to evolve towards using individuals merely to promote social growth and efficiency. Pierce's response is that euphoria and well-being are associated with dominance, assertiveness, and enhanced motivation, whereas subordination and inactivity are associated with depression. Rats given Prozac transcend the pecking order. Previously subordinate and depressive animals don't let themselves be messed around with, he says. Other things being equal, it's far harder to dominate people who are extremely happy. Charlton recognizes that happiness does not necessarily lead to meekness, and that happy people are in fact often extremely driven, but he argues nevertheless that a society which decided to calibrate their citizens to be less than optimally happy, but instead very driven to sacrifice their happiness in the interest of the nation, would prevail against a society where citizens were maximally happy. Pierce does not attempt to predict how we'll spend our pain-free lives. He doesn't think it is up to him to offer advice, just as it is not up to anesthetists or pain relief specialists to offer advice on how to spend our days in the absence of physical pain. According to Bostrom, Pierce's greatest contribution lies in the way that he does not shy away from the fact that happiness and suffering have their roots in the biological functioning of the brain, even though studies show that life events have relatively little long-term impact on subjective well-being, whereas biology has a great deal of impact. fact, most utilitarians do not suggest brain modification as a way of achieving the greatest happiness for the greatest number. If they mention drugs, genetic engineering, or other forms of brain manipulation, it is often in passing, in a footnote, and with apparent embarrassment, says Bostrom. Pierce realizes that in the long run, direct manipulation of brains will have vastly greater impact on subjective well-being than any environmental interventions could possibly have, and this one important insight is the almost exclusive focus of his work. Bostrom urges us not to let pessimism about near-term problems of implementation confuse us into rejecting the vision of what we might hope to be able to achieve in the long run. As he points out, the core idea of Pierce's hedonistic imperative, that we should minimize suffering, does not depend on sharing Pierce's views about utilitarianism or mind-brain identity. It is not even necessary to assume that all suffering is bad in order for the hedonistic imperative to make sense, says Bostrom. By anybody's standards, there is a huge amount of unnecessary and undeserved suffering that is just bad and that we should get rid of. This has been the Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is Ed Shep signing off. Beep. You are listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.